Welcome to the Agile Book Club. Here are your hosts, Justina and Paul.
I was so happy to see you and so glad that we had finally sorted out the connection issues that I didn't bother to hit the record button. We got none of that.
Oh my God.
None of that. Banter gone.
That was a good one. That was a good one. But Paul, it's good, you know, still 2 years of podcasting, surprises like that can happen. You cannot be ever sure of anything. Yes.
So what would the authors of this book say? That we have to look not at just what happened, just what we did, but the context in which we did it, with the assumption that in the context we were doing what seemed appropriate at the time. I don't think that applies here. I've got one job. Hit the record button and start talking, right? And it just goes to show you how few things the human mind can actually concentrate on at a time. I had one job, hit the record button, but I was so keen on trying to sort out these technical issues with the audio and such that particular job just completely slipped my mind. And so our listeners don't get to hear any cat stories. Listeners, we've been sharing cat stories for the last 5 minutes, and we only allotted 5 minutes for banter because Justina thinks that we need to be more disciplined. And so I have timestamps on my notes, and you get no more than 5 minutes of banter. And I don't know if we can squeeze the cat stories back in again. If they come up again, we might have to just do them in the after show. Discipline. Stick to the script.
Yes. But Paul, I think that the listeners deserve your cat story, your cat hairstyle story.
No. No. You had a good story too. Justina took this miserable, pathetic, scrawny cat, and she's put a kilo on it already. For you Americans, a kilogram. I don't know how much that is in pounds. I haven't thought in pounds in ages. Like at least 3 or 4 quarter pounders, maybe with fries, on this scrawny cat. And then she went and terrorized it.
Yes, then I went to terrorize my cat because I started exercising. And apparently my cat sees me as a danger when I exercise. So he takes a position to attack and he does like... And that's actually really crazy because at the beginning when he came to us, he was already like sleeping on my side of the bed. We're like, you know, good friends. One time I exercised, he never slept on my side of the bed anymore. When he sees me exercising first, I think that one day he will just attack me, but he's not there quite yet. But an hour after that, he runs away from me. I'm not his friend anymore. So that's actually pretty crazy. But Paul, as you said, the miserable cat already put on weight 1 kilo. And I am always the person who likes to feed people, feed animals. So I give him more candies and more food than it's supposed to. But the vet said that it still can go a little bit. And I think that after living on the street for a few years, you deserve a little obesity.
I'm not sure if that's exactly a problem that our listeners are struggling with, but if you have just gotten off the streets, then by all means, you owe it to yourself to get a Big Mac.
Exactly.
So,
but let's start, Paul, with the agile conversation. Let's see if our podcast today will be in the tone of the agile conversation.
I don't know. We've only worked together for what? What is it, like 5, 6, 7 years now? I don't know. Do we have trust? You've got a story in your head. You've got a story in your head that you use to explain everything you see, and you've never told me that story, so I'm not sure we can actually have an agile conversation. We're going to take a stab at it, or not. Or at least, you know, one thing, and I'm getting ahead of myself here, but one thing is all of our conversations are a matter of public record. And so the techniques of this book could easily be applied retroactively to them. So what are we talking about today?
Today we are reviewing Agile Conversation, Transform Your Conversations, Transform Your Culture by Douglas Square and Jeffrey Frederick.
I can't wait to meet them. These are two people I don't know, but I kind of fell in love with them while reading the book. Anybody who can write this book is a person I want to have a conversation with whom I would like to have a conversation. I'm sorry. We're being formal and disciplined here.
So, Paul, why? What's the reason for that? What did you think about the book?
Well, for one thing, it's original. You know, that's not fair. It's trickier than that. This book does something that I am guilty of doing myself, a guilty pleasure, maybe. You remember how I did the conference circuit linking together three ideas, mindfulness, nonviolent communication, and Nancy Klein's thinking spaces? They do something kind of like that. There are, in fact, very few original ideas in this book, which is fine, because the world is full of ideas. There are plenty of ideas out there. But what they've done is they've curated a collection of ideas into a single coherent theme and then presented it in a usable way. And that, I think, is a very valuable service to the community. So I enjoyed that. This was a very well-constructed book. I appreciate the amount of thought and research that went into making this book both light and easy to read, but also very dense and useful. So yeah, I think these are going to be people who I will very much enjoy meeting in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, but Paul, I'm sure you will enjoy, because after reading just 15 pages, I immediately jumped on YouTube and I was looking for some talks with them, and they are really nice people to have a conversation with. So I'm also looking forward to the interview. But when I think about the Agile Conversation as the book, I remember when someone also told me about it before you said that we are going to read it. And my first reaction was like, what? Agile Conversations? You know, what does it mean? Are we going to have now, you know, there's experts in Agile Conversations, you know, training how to have the conversation? You know, I was just thinking that it's, you know, something like newly created, and that we are going to, I don't know, have the retrospective meeting in the tone of the Agile Conversation. You know, I was a little bit skeptical, but once I got into the book, I really enjoyed that it actually goes from the principles that if you want to have the successful company, you should have a culture. And if you want to have a good culture, you should have good conversations too. So I made, when I was reading the book, I made my own acronym, 3 C's. Company, culture, conversation, you know, because they have their 4 R. And I was just, you know, just laughing with myself. But anyway, for you listeners, why you should read this book? I think that, again, disregard of the position that you are in your organization, you are having conversations. And I'm sure that each of you were at least once in your life when you felt that this doesn't lead us anywhere, or you felt like you are going to explode, or you felt that you are stressed about having the conversation, or you knew that it's going to be challenging. And this book actually gives you the tools and ideas how to approach different kind of conversation in order to create the culture that can strive for the best. So for me, it was a missing link for like some transformation that we want to do, some, you know, to achieve the success within a team and different aspects. But it was like very basic. And the best thing about the book, like for me, was that having a conversation is a skill that we can actually exercise every day. So having the tools and having the opportunity every day can help us to master that.
True, true, true. Although, I got to say, you know, unlike you, I know you read the book as early as you can. Sometimes you read it twice and you watch all the videos. You immerse yourself in things. I do just the opposite. I read the book as fast as I can, as close as possible to the recording time, so I have a fresh perspective. Literally, I just finished reading this book 2 hours ago, and I started it yesterday afternoon. And I would be a little cautious about recommending it to everyone who has conversations. And the reason is, I did it completely wrong. I sat down, I read the whole book. It's an easy read. It took me less than 4 hours, end to end, I think. And yet, I'd say that I probably only got, a fraction of a few percent of a value, which is not really a mathematical term. I got a very small amount of value from this book. I got some clever ideas, some that I've already used. I had a coaching call with one of my clients today, and I told her about some of the ideas in the book. So the book certainly has ideas which are catchy and sound interesting. But if I were to recommend it, I'd have to say that this book takes at least 6 weeks to read, maybe 12. And the reason is that this book outlines six types of conversations, each one of which must be mastered before the other one can be really valuable. And mastery of a conversation style or technique takes an enormous amount of work. And we're going to get into that, I think, a little bit when we get into the takeaways. But the authors aren't telling you how to have a good conversation. They're telling you how to sit down and methodically analyze your conversations that you've already had and then learn from them. And so if you don't sit down and do the work, and you can say it doesn't look too hard to do, but when I came across this yesterday, I thought, well, I've got a conversation I would love to do this with. I got into it's not an argument, but I got into an interesting back and forth with a tester that I work with about a conversation I've had a million times, right? About the idea of moving tasks backwards on a Kanban board. And I know I'm right. Of course I'm right. I'm extremely experienced in this. I've been a Kanban coach and trainer for almost as long as there's been Kanban. Of course I'm right. I know this for a fact. I can prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt. But I can't seem to convince anybody in a conversation of this. And I don't know why they don't see my brilliance. So I thought I could just sit down and analyze this conversation because it happened on Slack. So I have the actual text. Guess what? I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I didn't make the time to sit down and analyze this conversation. You know what I did instead?
No.
You can guess. I watched a bunch of reaction videos to Pentatonics.
My friend, Paul.
So here's the thing. You can't read a book and have better conversations. You have to read a book and then do a lot of work and practice.
Yes.
To have better conversations. Because a good idea is not going to serve you well when you're in the middle of, something that triggers you.
Yes, but Paul, you are like completely right, because I think like every aspect of this book, every brilliant idea requires work from your side. Like the first one, like one of my first takeaways was about the fear, about the conversations that we are going to have, and you might be afraid of them, or that they come from the place of fear when there is not a lot of trust in the organization. And one of the exercises that they suggest is actually to visualize the fear. Like, I mean, to list down all of the aspect of that, the kind of scary, or for example, to do that with the team. And now I'm just thinking, oh my God, where with all of those meetings that we are having and all of the deadlines that we are having, where we will find time, even though I know it's useful, even though I know we should, but it's again, yes, it's another great tool that you are not, might not use because you don't have time.
The authors would say that if your team is working under a state of fear, that that's probably the most important thing to deal with first. And yet
we go into like, another meeting that is already organized and scheduled, yes? And we kind of, but Paul, it's sometimes crazy, like how we know how some things would help us, but we don't do that.
This is one of the reasons why a coach is so useful. I was talking to a client, and she was explaining how she took over a project that had just piles and piles of meetings. And nobody remembered why they were happening, but they were taking up an enormous amount of time. And I just said, well, cancel them. Cancel them and see if anyone complains. Sometimes you just need another person to give you permission to focus on what you know you ought to be focusing on, to do what you know you ought to do. And it's really easy when you look at your calendar and it is just full of back-to-back product development meetings and stand-up meetings and retrospective meetings and this meeting and that meeting and the other meeting, you kind of sometimes need somebody to come over and say, you know, your team is scared to death of you and they're building the wrong product because they won't, but they won't tell you. Maybe you should talk to them about it instead of doing another planning meeting or before the next planning meeting.
Yeah, that's true.
Not that I'm saying your team is terrified of you. I'm just speculating that maybe your team is terrified of you.
No, actually, like this example was not from the current team, but one of the things, Paul, that you said yesterday and that really resonated with me was when we are talking about the product owners who don't ask the team, don't ask for their opinion. And I said, oh my God, you have to have such a high ego to don't ask your team. And you said something that really stuck with me, like, no, you don't, that you don't think it's a high ego, that it's actually fear. And yes, I think, Paul, that we are also right that sometimes when we don't have those conversations about the fear, we tend to build the wrong things because the position, how the product owners or other stakeholders act, they come from the place of fear. So those conversations, as you said, they should have happened.
And that can actually lead into that conversation. This is one of my takeaways. I'm jumping towards the back of the book, but it was just because of what you were saying, it was this idea of compliance versus commitment. And there's a great deal of comfort, I think, in being in a position of authority and knowing, as most people know, that their view of the world is accurate, objectively true, and that anybody who could see it the way they would agree with them. And so they know best. And I see this a lot, especially in startups. When I was working with a development company that did offshore software development, most of our clients were startups. And I think I've made on this podcast before the observation that it's kind of crazy, but it's actually easier to be agile in a corporation than in a startup, because a startup has one person right in the center who is just a pile of ego and fear. Ego, because they're finally building out their singular vision, and fear, because it's their own money. And so it's very difficult to negotiate with such a person, whereas in a corporation, they're more goal-focused, and if you've got an idea that might achieve the goal, they're willing to give it a try. But that is this difference between compliance and commitment, and the idea that it's very comforting as that person who is fearful and certain at the same time, fearful that things could go wrong and it might come back to you and such, and certain that your view of the world is the correct one, to think that you're working with a bunch of people who work for you and they do what they're told. Because that's a nice, orderly view of the world. And the trouble is that compliance, doing what you're told, following the rules, fails in two key respects. One, it falls apart under conditions of uncertainty. So as soon as there's something a situation which is outside of the boundaries in which these rules were originally made, people don't know how to behave. And secondly, it absolutely kills creativity. So if you want a group of intelligent people that you've hired and paid a lot of money to passionately try to put their best efforts into what you're trying to create, then you also have to make them partners in the process. And there are critical conversations that have to happen in order to do that, in order to invite their willing commitment to a shared vision. And this is the terrifying thing. And I've been a product owner before. It wasn't that hard for me, perhaps. I want to say it wasn't that hard for me, because I remember often being asked advice about how to make something look or how to implement such and such a feature and saying, you know, our users seem to like it this way. I hate it, but our users seem to like it this way and we're building it for them, not for me. But if you're actually seeking commitment to a shared goal, you can't impose a shared goal on another person. You have to be open to collaboratively arriving at a shared goal, which necessarily isn't going to be exactly the same as the one you had in the head your head before you had the conversation, which is tricky. And that's one of the reasons why it's one of the last chapters of the book. I think it might be the last chapter in the book, but I just wanted to skip to that because it fit in so nicely to what we were talking about. I wonder if we should go back to the beginning a little bit, though.
Yes.
So yes. Fundamentally, I think there's two foundational ideas in this book. Mm-hmm. One is that you can improve the quality of your conversations by analyzing conversations that you're having. And the technique for doing this, and you really have to look in the book and look at all of the examples, because the book is full of examples. But the technique for doing this is deceptively simple, and that is to take a single piece of paper, divide it in half, and on the right-hand side of the paper, write down what was said, simply, briefly. It doesn't have to be exact, but generally write down what you remember from the conversation, what was actually said. And then in the left-hand column, you write down what you were thinking as you or the other person was saying it. And then you compare the two. And depending on the goal of the conversation, the kind of conversation it is, and they talk about six specific kinds of conversation, you're looking at different things. And they tell you exactly what to look for, how to score this conversation. And so that's kind of like the fundamental idea in the book. And that's the reason why we say that you have to be willing to put a lot of time and effort into it. Because how many people walk away from a conversation and say, you know what I'd really like to do is sit down and draft out that whole conversation on a piece of paper, think about my thoughts and feelings, critically analyze them, apply a scoring method to it, figure out everything I did wrong, and then go back to that person and try to have it again.
Yes, exactly. And also, you should try to have this conversation maybe with other people, do some role-playing, or, you know, not only finish it once, because you are not going to master the skill of having the conversation by scripting one conversation. Yeah. I would like to meet people, you know, who are doing that, you know?
Do you remember? Do you remember we interviewed George Dinwiddie? Was it Dinwiddie? Is that his name?
Dinwiddie, yes.
We interviewed George Dinwiddie, and one of the things he kept talking about in the interview is what he was learning from looking through his notebooks about conversations he had 10, 20 years ago. So we met a guy who was doing this, and we still didn't decide it was a good enough idea to do ourselves.
But Paul, no, we met him, yes, that's true, but was he scoring?
He was recording the conversation. He was thinking critically about them. He was thinking critically about them. And he was doing something different. He wasn't just having a conversation, thinking critically about it, and then trying to improve the next one. He was going back and critically analyzing conversations he had years and years and years ago. So he was constantly reliving his own social life at work as like a running retrospective in his head.
Would you like to do it? For imagine that you did it actually, that you have like the notebooks, journals with like 20 years of conversations. Yeah. Would you like to run your social life, like, you know, work life and everything like trapped, like all over again and analyze?
Are you kidding? I don't even listen to my own podcast. When I'm done editing this thing, I am done with it. That's why it's so unnerving when some guy on LinkedIn types up verbatim something that I said in an earlier podcast. And I'm like, no, I'm done with that episode. It happened and it's gone.
But Paul, that was a good quote. That was something smart that you say. I know.
Thank
that
goodness.
Now
I say like so many stupid things.
I patronize you.
Yeah. Okay, so your next takeaway. Let's get back to this podcast. Come on, we got a job to do here, and we're supposed to be disciplined.
Okay.
Serious.
So back to normal. So back to the beginning of the book. Actually, the first conversation that they dig into was trust. And while reading that, I was actually reviewing all of the organization that I've been in. And I was thinking that only two of them had trust. And that was actually the terrifying thing for me. But the one of the takeaway from the book was that you cannot have the conversation about the fear. You cannot align people on the vision, on why. You cannot expect people actually to be committed or, you know, to build a common commitment. There is no accountability conversation if we don't have trust. And the crazy thing that was said that and that I really, really liked is not about having one story, but it was about the art of aligning all of the stories, that every person in the team might have their own story, their own vision, but if they don't present that, if we don't align on them, if we don't have the trust that there is the place for all of them, we cannot move, like, you know, any farther. And I was also wondering a little bit because, you know, on the one hand, sometimes we treat the job that it's like just to pay our bills. Yes. So I was thinking, like, if you are in the position in the organization that, you know, you work just to work, but you don't really care. You don't really need the trust. Is it possible to build the trust in this workplace? Is it possible or is it valuable for everyone to have a trust in the organization?
Doesn't that kind of come down to what they were talking about when they were talking about people's stories, the stories they tell themselves about who they are and where they are and that they use to interpret why they do what they do? I meet people who think that some people think that way. And I think the whole idea that there are people who come to work just for a paycheck is very theory X thinking. There are people, I mean, I believe it happens. I believe it happens that there are people who come to work just for a paycheck, but that's not what they want for their job. That's just all their job has to offer them. So if you meet a person who has no passion whatsoever for the work, it's not because they're not a passionate person. I have this conversation about laziness often. The number of managers out there who believe that there's such a thing as lazy people, watch those people in their lives. Watch how they do the things that they love. There's whatever it is that they love doing, whether it is playing video games or spending time with their children or building model railroads, whatever it is that they love, when they're doing it, there is nothing lazy about that person. They are obviously not lazy. So what is it about their job in this environment, this job you've created for them, in this environment you've created for them that is sucking all of the love out of them?
Yes.
So, yeah. So to that point, I think that if one had an honest conversation to try to uncover those stories, one might very well find a point at which you could have a conversation about where the passion was missing, where the story that the person was telling themselves about why they come to work and what their function in the workplace is could be open to some negotiation about conditions, about autonomy, about whatever it is that they're missing that they love. You can probably find a way, like Mary Poppins said, famously, to, you know, find a spoonful of sugar.
Yes, I think Paul, that again, yes, you are right. And also, I think, like, it was the last part of the book when they were talking about the theory Y and theory X and how it actually, plays out.
Indeed, I think it's a shame we still have to talk about some of these rather older ideas, these older and We shouldn't still have to talk about 3X and 3Y, but we still run into it. And this is another one of the things. This is another one of the things that I think is really powerful about this book and really useful is the way they not only state in a variety of ways, but also illustrate so clearly that there is, I don't care who you are, there is a disconnect between what you say you believe and what you do. And this kind of conversational analysis is a way to uncover that disconnect. You can say you're 100% theory Y, except for that jerk over there who just insists undoing a backwards job at half speed. Aside from him, you're a theory Y person. And you wouldn't even say that. You would just say you're a theory Y thinker, but then you treat that person like you didn't trust them. You treat that person like you think they're lazy. And not even realize the disconnect unless you either have somebody outside pointing out the inconsistencies in your behavior. And there's another one, because they talk about that in the book as well. I think it was in the third chapter, they point out something that, what was it? It was actually after one of my takeaways. One of my takeaways is I like the way they told the story of Og and Ugg.
Mm-hmm.
Which we've all heard a variation of this story. But the idea is that Og and Ugg are two people who live in the distant past, 40,000 years ago or so. And they go out hunting together. And they're walking through the forest, and there's this rustling, and they're just looking for rabbits or something. There's this rustling in the bushes. Some large thing is coming through the bushes. And Og runs and climbs up a tree, thinking, it must be a bear. And Og is optimistic. He thinks, wow, maybe instead of a rabbit, we're going to get a deer this time. And he smiles, and he starts moving towards it. And that kind of optimism is charming. But guess which one of them is going to live to reproduce and pass on their genes? And so we end up with a kind of natural inclination to the word isn't resistance. What is the word that they used? It might, when faced with any kind of stress, pressure, or fear, we respond defensively. And I think that's the word that they use. We respond defensively. And I love the way they put it, that we are so unaware of our own defense response that when faced with somebody pointing out our defense response, we still refuse to see it.
Yes. You know, I also like that one. And also the example, like when they say, whoever would you ask how you are going to make important decision in your organization? Yes, everyone would say that, yes, we are going to ask everyone, collect the stories, dig into that, see what everyone has to say. Then we'll make a collective decision. And, so many people, that would be the first response. But once you have to make the decision, it so often happen through one person who takes that decision, because they are like in the rush, in the rush. They don't have the time, they don't have energy, or they are afraid that they are going to take a wrong decision because they will rely on some other people who maybe are lower in the organization, or they think that actually in reality, asking other people for the decision when I am manager might not look so good. So I have to be like in the position of power and take that decision. But it's really, crazy, because everyone like intuitively will say, yes, that's the way you have to take decision if it influences everyone in the organization. But then again, the reality is different.
We are all perfectly rational creatures, fully in control of objective reality. never doubt it. So there are a bunch of other ones. I want to talk about some of the bigger concepts and some of the more useful concepts. There were a couple of, I told you that I sat down, I read this book. I didn't do it in one session. I did it in like three sessions, but I basically read it end to end over a period of 24 hours in less than 4 hours. And so I didn't do any of the exercises. I mean, I didn't do any of the work. And yet there were still active, usable things I could take away from them. And one of them that I really liked was this idea that they describe as coherence busting. And I have already used it. Like, it hasn't been 24 hours since I started reading this book, and I've already found two occasions to use this technique. And the idea is, I don't entirely understand the phrase coherence busting. I'm just going to talk about what the technique actually is. And that is that when you see a person's behavior, it is perfectly natural, maybe even under some circumstances healthy, especially if their behavior is endangering you or something, to immediately ascribe some underlying motivations and intent. they're doing this because they're horrible people bent on destroying the company or whatever. Or they're doing this just to spite me. How many times, this is something Marshall Rosenberg talks about too. You know, a person does a thing and you have an emotion. And you make the mistake of thinking that that thing and that emotion are not only directly linked, like that thing caused the emotion, but they must have done that thing with the intention of causing that emotion. They did that to hurt me. They did that to upset me. They did that to push my buttons. And that's normal and natural. But the idea that you can, by linking this to Kahneman's ideas of System 1 and System 2 thinking, that is a System 1 response. It is a response based on simple heuristics or a limbic response, if it's fear or aversion. And you can engage your System 2 by doing a simple exercise of asking yourself, how many other explanations could I come up with for this person's behavior? So they did this thing. It really made me angry, and it looked like they were doing it just to sabotage the project. But what other reasons might they have done it? Might they have done it because they're having a really bad day? Might they have done it because they... Goodness, we're talking about these very not even abstract. It's at too high a level. I want to think of a specific instance that is not real life because it happened to me twice in real life, and I don't want to reveal anything awkward for anybody. But there was a person. Goodness, good example. I'm gonna have to hack some of this out. Okay, here's a good example. My wife is very envious of my brother. I've got a younger brother who is just the most laid back, easygoing, just friendly guy, doesn't get ruffled easily. And we were driving with him once in Dallas, Texas, and somebody cut him off on the road. It was frightening. He slammed on the brakes. And his comment was something like, "I'm glad I'm not having her day." Not what most people would do. Most people would say, that idiot doesn't care about anybody else, risking everybody's life, thinks she's more important than everyone else. My brother's first reaction was that she's having a rotten day. But that would be, if I was trying to use the system, that might be my second thought. My third thought might be that she's rushing to an emergency. She just got a call that her son is missing. You know, you can come up with any number of different explanations for why a person might behave erratically driving on the road. And two things happen when you do this. Number one, you're engaging System 2 thinking, so you're stepping back and you're actually using your rational mind. But more importantly, I think, and they allude to this, but I don't think they say this precisely, is that the moment you have two or three or four or five or six different explanations, you've created doubt. You no longer know what's actually going on in this situation. And doubt creates curiosity. And curiosity is a much healthier place to come from to engage with another person than judgment. And so I like that concept a lot. Somebody does something, you have some kind of a negative response to it. It's less likely if you have a positive response, I guess, but it's just as applicable. Somebody does something and you have a response to it, a kind of gut feel. Take a moment and list as many other plausible explanations for that behavior as you can come up with, just to break yourself out of that way of thinking.
And you know, and I also thought about it, that it's kind of refreshing, because in so many cases we just tend to jump into this vicious, reinforcing feedback loop when, you know, the more this person does it, the angrier I get. And, you know, we start... Even if we don't want to hate that person, we are just becoming so annoyed with the behavior. And then the triggers, like when we see even the sign that it will happen again, then we are just, you know, using the whole loop that was already created there. I actually tried this coherence exercise too, and I have to say that it's very powerful, and it really creates the curiosity that you can get. Yeah, because One of the additional things for me from that exercise was, as you said, to awaken the curiosity. So I also tried it like recently at work, and the outcome was like completely unexpected. So yes, highly recommended for everyone. One of the funny thoughts that I had while reading the book is like the more book you read, the more experience you have and opinions about other books. Because I remember when we were reading Canavian book, and it was, and then I was watching Dave Snowden video when he was saying that he hates the Lean Startup, that it's like the worst book that could actually be written, that it's not true and that it doesn't work that way. And I had a similar impression when I was reading Agile Conversation, and actually the conversation about start with why, or like don't start with why, was actually in the third part of the book, because we can go to like, you know, TED Talk and listen to Simon Sinek, who is saying start with why, you have to start with why to build the, you know, organization, the culture, the people who will be driven by themselves, they have to know why. Yes, but in Agile Conversation, the conversation about why we do the things come in the later phase. You can't have this conversation again if you don't have trust, if there is fear. So they actually explicitly say, don't start with why. And that was just, you know, my funny thought, that sometimes if you only stick to a few books that you read, or like, you know, a few thought leaders, that you can just, you know, be really narrow. I don't want to say narrow-minded, but I will say narrow-minded, or like, you know, really opinionated about one area. So that was really interesting for me, and proved me that yes, you have to read more to have more diverse opinion and what, yeah, and do a little bit more research on some topics instead of just repeating that now everyone has to start with why.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of my favorite quotations was from that section where they said, trying to give a group of people that doesn't trust you, that doesn't have a shared understanding of and doesn't have trust and such, that doesn't have a healthy environment already, to try to give that group an aspiring why conversation would be like Captain Bly trying to deliver a motivational speech to the crew of the Bounty just before the mutiny.
Yes.
You can't talk about why if nobody trusts you, if nobody's listening. If they think it's just, if your aspirational speech, if your why is just a trick to motivate them into working weekends, if that's what they think, then they're not going to be on board. I've got one more takeaway I want to get to, though, before we get to the favorite quotations, because it was like the one other really big useful idea that I think is pretty unique to this book, and that was the whole idea of TDD for people. Mm-hmm. Now, it's based on other research, but basically the concept is when we look at a person, when we're like with a person and they respond to something in a way that doesn't make sense to us, there's a bunch of things going on there. At the base of it is whatever that person observed and experienced. And we were there with them. We observed and experienced the same thing. But between that observation and their behavior and reaction to it, there are a whole bunch of things that happen, which is referred to as the ladder of inference. I've got it open in front of me because I don't have all of these memorized. So basically, a person observes something happening, but then they select particular elements of what they observed as relevant data. Because our brain's doing this all the time. What's relevant? What's irrelevant? We can't think about everything at the same time. They might find different things relevant in what they observed than you find relevant. And then they take that data and they add meanings to it based on their own personal experiences, their background, their culture, and beliefs. And then they make assumptions based on those things. And they draw conclusions about what's happening. And then they adopt beliefs about what's happening, about the behaviors, about the reasons behind it, and about the way in which they ought to behave in this situation. And then they act on those beliefs. And you only see the beginning and the end of that chain of inference or that ladder of inference. And the authors suggest that you can do something they call TDD for people, test-driven development for people. You start at the bottom and you say, hold on a second. I saw this happen. Is that what you saw? And the other person might say, yeah, I saw it too. Didn't that make you furious? No, let's not skip to the end of the ladder of inference. So what do you think was significant there? And the person might say, his tone of voice was completely inappropriate. Now, there's a few levels there, but you might not have noticed the tone of voice as being significant at all. That's how he always talks. Here, right at the base of the ladder, you did a test to see if you both heard the same thing. You were paying attention to the words, and the other person was paying attention to the tone. So you did a test to see whether you were looking at the same thing, and you found out the test failed. Oh, you were paying more attention to their tone. Describe that to me. What was the tone? Because I wasn't paying attention to that. And once you both understand you're talking about the same thing, you can go up one more ladder, one more step of the ladder, and say, you know, what did you think that meant? What does that tone of voice mean to you? Does it mean that this person is angry? No, it didn't sound angry to me at all. It sounded frustrated. Again, I did a test. I tested to see whether they thought that tone meant anger, and I was wrong. The test failed. And I got the correct result. And so I got to go one step up. And so this is a way of having a conversation with somebody, just establishing understanding at each level, rather than going straight to the top of the ladder and saying, that reaction was completely inappropriate to the situation. What were you thinking? Because it's harder to go back down the ladder, especially by yourself. So I thought that whole concept, and listeners, I get some grief about this sometimes. You got to understand, this podcast is completely ad lib. We don't know, we've got a structure for it, and I've got some notes and such, but the way I'm going to describe these things is off the top of my head, and I don't always do the best job I possibly can. Read this section of the book, it's totally worth reading. I feel like I didn't do it justice, and I reserve the right to do that because I'm doing my best here. I really did not do that section of the book justice. But if the concept of diligently testing assumptions rather than leaping to judgment sounds interesting to you, then go straight to chapter 3 of Agile Conversations. It's a great read.
But Paul, I also don't think that we have to feel obligated to explain everything in the best way to listeners, because it's not a webinar about the book that we are the authors. It's just, you know, our conversation about the book.
Well, it comes back to us. It comes back to us in the Slack channel. People like quote me word for word and said, what did you mean by this? And it's like, well, there is a gap between what I meant and what I said.
Yes, that's. But Paul, hashtag influencer.
I'm trying to use my influence responsibly.
Yes, that's true. But still, you were never quoted in the way, like, you know, that. That you said something so horrible. You know, I think that there could be like more horrible quotation that could go from the podcast. You know?
Oh, yeah. I've said horrible things on this podcast.
Yeah, so.
Probably even this particular one.
And accidentally you didn't hit the record button in the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, first time for everything. Okay, that was the second. I know. Second time for everything. So you said we need to be disciplined and try to keep this to under an hour. So quotations. I already shared one of mine. Favorite quotations.
So I will share mine.
Please. I'm all ears.
Oh, Paul, you always make me laugh. Okay. We need to be having the right conversations, building the right culture if we want to improve our chance of success. I think that should be the underlying subtitle of the book, which leads me to my brilliant summary that I use in the elevator pitch, company culture conversation. Paul, next book by me, company culture conversation.
How about just C cubed?
Oh, beautiful. Thank you, Paul.
And, you know, mine, my top one was exactly the same, only a whole lot shorter. When we change our conversations, we change our culture. Now, you know me, I was trained as an anthropologist, and so this speaks to me to some extent, because I often, when I'm thinking about culture change, I think of culture change in two primary ways, maybe three. And the anthropologists out there are going to tear me to pieces because these are not academic. But one is that culture changes when people learn new things. Change what people know about a thing, and their behavior changes. And this is the whole approach to things like changing behaviors towards witchcraft or AIDS prevention, for example, through education. They do educational programs about the use of condoms. Eventually, as more and more people realize how condoms work and why they prevent AIDS, they change the behavior. Simple. Change what people know when you change the behavior. It's probably the hardest way to change a culture. Changing behavior, there's a very strong link between behavior and culture. People act like they... culture drives how people behave, but if you change how people behave, psychologically, they have to make sense of that because nobody believes they are a nonsensical being. So if people behave differently, then they necessarily have to start thinking differently to make sense of their own behavior. And so you can change culture through ritual and practices. And this is a variation on that. We are a very social species. And one of the things that I like, one of the things that fascinates me about corporate culture is the idea that humans don't have, no human has a single culture. We have a culture which we carry with us from our own lived experiences, but we know that when we're in church, the rules are different. And we know that when we're in the office, the rules are different. We know that when we're in school, the rules are different. And we interact with people differently. We behave differently. Some things are appropriate that aren't appropriate in other places. And so the idea that we can, the thing that fascinates me is the idea of this now that we're online. And I'm really curious to watch how this happens, because I observed and did some research when I was working on my PhD about how people change their behavior when they're online. And basically become just monsters. Perfectly decent people go online and give them a little bit of anonymity, and they can become absolute monsters. And the idea that maybe we can manipulate these cultures and create spaces in which people behave, can behave in one way, which is conducive to an organization when they're online, and a different way conducive to the organization when they're offline. And so I'm wrapping on this way too long, but the idea that we are social people who organize ourselves through conversation, if we change the way we talk to each other, that's going to have a profound, profound influence on the culture of the organization. Which was, I'm sorry, way too big of an explanation. It seems like a simple concept, but I attributed a great deal of meaning to it. And so I really like it. Changing your conversations changes your culture. Powerful.
Yes. Powerful. So last one from me. Non-genuine questions are used to make a point rather than learn something new. And those kind of questions, I think that we all sometimes use them, especially if we're already like tired in the conversation and we want to just, you know, make a point, but we still ask a question that only will prove that we are right. And today, for example, I was just making a mark on the paper when I felt that I asked this type of question, and I was terrified. I was really terrified. Even though that I was subconscious about it, I was still terrified.
That was one of my takeaways I didn't get to, this idea that so many of our questions are non-genuine. They're designed to manipulate or lead people someplace. And it's actually really rare that people ask a question and then just sit there with an open mind, really curious about the answer. Like, don't you think you could just try it for once? Is not a question that you're open to the idea. No, I absolutely do not think I could try it once. That's not an option. That's not what I was listening for. But couldn't you do it for me? That's not a question that's open to any answer. No, there's only one possible answer to that question. Or like the example that I put on LinkedIn when I was talking about questions. Don't you think that an example of a question that was not open and open-minded and friendly. Don't you think that your gluttony might be related to your obesity? That's not an open question. An open question is one that could be answered in a surprising way, and you would welcome the surprise. And how often does that happen? So yeah, I'm glad you brought that up in the favorite quotations, because the difference between a genuine question and the ones that we ask most of the time is a really important one in this book. So we did it. I think we're going to get a podcast into 1 hour. I think we're actually going to do it within 1 hour. All we really need to do is talk about what we're going to read next.
Yes, and here I'm selfish. I'm super selfish this time because I said to Paul, we are going to read the book related to product because that's what I need. And then I put the non-genuine question saying, don't you want Paul to include also product owners in our listeners? They deserve something.
They're also agile.
They are also agile. So I manipulated Paul into reading the book in the area that I really need, but
I got to choose the book.
You got to choose the
book. She was not so horrible. She said, no, we're definitely, I mean, there was no question there. We're going to read
There was no question even.
I literally said, I really don't want to read a product management book because I am just immersing myself into agile culture change right now. And product management is not one of the things I'm focusing on at the moment. But I understand intractability when I see it. I mean, I listen to reason when I hear it. And so I said, fine, as long as I get to choose the book.
Yes. And just to, maybe not to justify myself, but to be a kind person and kind co-host, Paul, the next two books can be choose completely to facilitate your working adventure. Because also Tom, he suggested, okay, tell Paul that you will choose like every third book. That will be fair. So I will choose every third book. So next month, dear listeners, you are going to read with me or at least listen to what we read. It will be the book written by Melissa Perry, and she was actually one of the speakers on the ACE conference before I joined ACE and before I met Paul. So I'm very sorry I didn't have a chance to meet her in person, but at least I will read her book, Escaping the Build Trap, How Effective Product Management Creates Real Value. And I think that I think a lot of our listeners will benefit. I hope that I'm not going to be the only one person who will benefit from that podcast. But if I will be, listeners, please let us know to never, ever do that again.
Wait, but I chose the book. No, I'm sure this will be good. Number one, I feel guilty because when Melissa was here, she and I got along really well. We had a lot of great conversations. I really liked her. This was her first book. I want to be supportive. And ever since she published it, I have felt bad for not reading it. But I don't do product management anymore. It's not a book for me. I'd be reading it just as a friend. And which is a good enough reason to read a book, I would think, right? Mm-hmm. I've read books just because a friend wrote them. But this is one that I haven't gotten around to reading. So that's part of the reason. But the other part of the reason is that I've heard her speak a number of times. I've had some great conversations with her. I think she has something to say that would be really relevant for you, Justyna. And of course, I just kind of assume that all of our listeners are just like you. So whatever's good for you is good for them. No, wait, whatever. As long as someone benefits. But it got really good reviews when it came out. People were really enthusiastic about this book. And it still is one of the highest rated books I see on Amazon. It comes up top in the listings when you search for product management, even though the word product management isn't in the title. And so I'm sure it's a fabulous book. I'm just sure it is. I'm sure it is. Yeah. Trust me. Read it.
I trust. Yeah, exactly.
And you too, listeners, if you want to join us, we talk about books on our Slack channel. There'll be a link to it in the show notes, as well as a link to find the book if you want to read along with us so that you're not hearing it all for the first time a month from now. But if you don't want to do that, it's fine. You can just listen in. We'll tell you what you need to know. And stay tuned, because in 2 weeks, we are going to be interviewing the authors of Agile Conversations. And then we'll be back again 2 weeks later to talk about Melissa Perry's book that I should have read years ago and didn't. And yeah, I'm sure she'll forgive me for that. We'll see. If she doesn't forgive me, she'll refuse to do an interview. And then we'll know that things are not okay between us anymore.
Excellent.
But as for the rest, so Justin and I are going to keep going. My cat story got cut off. If you want to hear, did you hear that? That was a
yes.
pun. That was a pun. My cat does my hair. If you just want to hear silly cat stories, and this is one. I tried a completely different format for a daily stand-up with my team last week, and they love it. And also, we've got some ideas for improving on lean coffee. So Justin and I have a few other things that we're going to be talking about. They're not about the book, but they will all be in the after show, which is available on Patreon to anybody who even just buys us a cup of coffee. $1 a month. You can help support the show on Patreon and get access to the after shows, which we post there, which are, I mean, if I'm being honest, mostly about cats. Love you all. See you back in 2 weeks.
Yeah, see you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.